Hey, what's up, everybody? My name's MJ, and you're listening to the MTG in Quarantine podcast. As usual, I'd like to give a shout-out to my local game store, Guardian Games. You can find Guardian Games on the web at ggportland.com. On today's episode, I've got a really exciting collaboration for y'all. I'm introducing Raphael, a.k.a. Ursa Bearwalker, to the channel. How's it going today?
Today is going so far so good.
All right, that's great to hear. So, on today's episode, we're going to be talking about decks in your stable. More specifically, though, we're not talking about common archetypes, you know, the Voltron, Aristocrats, combo, things like that. We're actually talking more about deck-building philosophy than those traditional archetypes. Do you want to talk to the audience a little bit more about what you mean by this?
So typically when people talk about the types of decks that are in their stable, which mm-hmm. is a term that I believe was coined by the folks over at the Commander Social podcast. Yep.
Good podcast, in case anyone else listening to this podcast needs another great podcast to listen to.
Great podcast. Absolutely wonderful, and they're wonderful guys. When they talk about the types of decks in their stable, like they have spreadsheets and they like actually have the decks that they have. When people typically talk about what they have, they tend to lean into describing their deck in terms of the common archetypes that we see in other formats mm-hmm. of Magic. So they'll talk about things like, oh, I have a burn deck, or oh, I have an Aristocrats deck, or oh, I have a Voltron deck, that kind of a thing. And these can be very helpful when it comes to prescribing different ways of constructing a deck, because obviously a Voltron deck is going to lean into certain types of cards, whereas an Aristocrats deck will lean into certain other types of cards. But I think when it comes to talking about a well-rounded stable, we really need to be talking about having a deck, basically having a deck for every situation.
Okay.
And in order to... I'm sorry?
Yeah. So could you go more into that?
So we all... So every meta is going to be somewhat different, and the people that comprise that meta are slightly different. And we all have different goals and that we're trying to accomplish in a game of each, right? We know this from everything from the super casuals, the chair tribal people, all the way through the CEDH crowd who are to combo out as quickly as possible, mm-hmm. right? And in between. Having... So what I've done here is I've actually constructed, I'm going to call it a new type of archetype for thinking about your stable. This is something I came up with earlier this week, thinking about the types of decks that I actually enjoyed playing. Okay. And the easy way to remember it, because I love acronyms, especially when they're bear related, is that your stable needs to make sure that it has bears in it. B-E-A-R-S. Mm-hmm.
There's so your bear pun right there.
There's my bear pun right there.
We're off to a great start here already. So what does bears stand for?
So bears is going to stand for bombs, electioneering, aggressive, restricted, and safe. Okay? So when I talk about a bomb deck, what I'm talking about is I'm talking about a deck that is tends to have very explosive turns. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So these can be the these can essentially be classified into one of two types of decks, at least the way I'm conceptualizing them. You can have explosive bombs or you can have implosive bombs. Okay, your explosive bombs are going to be those ones that start slow at first. They're going to whip really close to victory and they've already done their damage. So they're going to essentially ride really close to that number one, number two slot for the rest of the game or until they're taken out. Contrast this with an implosive bomb, which is going to be your traditional glass cannons, right? They're going to there's going to be a huge whip ahead, and then they're just going to utterly crash if someone happens to destroy their combo or do something that prevents them from progressing the game forward.
Mm-hmm.
So I like having a bomb-style deck in my stable because it makes for those interesting stories, if nothing else. When you're on turn 15 and all of a sudden you pull off some insane combo that no one was expecting. So a really good example of a bomb in my stable is I have a Flibblethip the Lost deck.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and instead of doing something like the Protean staff combo, which I know a lot of people like to do in CEDH, where you can sort of stack the deck and, you know, draw the whole thing out, the deck essentially plays a mid strategy through most of the game until it manages to find something like a card called Mirror of Fate, which is a 5-mana artifact from core set M10.
Mm-hmm.
It says tap, sacrifice Mirror of Fate, choose up to 7 face-up exiled cards you own, exile all the cards from your library, then put the chosen cards on top of your library.
Oh, so kind of like a Doomsday sort of combo in blue.
Exactly. So what you do is you Mirror of Fate after you have something like, I don't know, the new Jace that came out in War of the Spark, Jace the Wielder of Mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
So you go ahead, you play the Jace, you crack the mirror, you say, okay, folks, you have one round of the table to either get rid of Jace or I'm going to win the game next turn. And you essentially put a clock on them. And it's a huge explosive thing that no one sees coming because you played a Planeswalker, you cracked an artifact, and now all of a sudden they're scrambling to try to find an answer.
Yeah, and since you have telegraphed your move, it's a lot different than just, drawing the typical deck draws with Labman, things like that, where it just can come right out of nowhere. You are at least giving people the opportunity to try to interact with that.
Yeah, you can play the whole thing out in one turn. I don't like to play that way because I like giving the opportunity for interaction. It also, again, it makes for those interesting stories to be like, okay, I had the combo all set up. I had some blue mana left open, and I said, okay, do what you can. And they came really close, but I managed to pull out to draw 3 cards and pull that counterspell out of nowhere to make sure that I was able to secure the win.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an example of an explosive, of what I would consider like a bomb type deck.
Yeah.
Now, do you have any bombs in your stable?
Not really as I traditionally would define it. I kind of stick more in the lower, the ARS version of Bears here, just because my local play group here, both before COVID and again, we still play over, video cameras right now. And we really don't stick with this sort of play typically because it rubs some people the wrong way, as well as also the fact that I personally don't really like playing combos an awful lot. So I typically, my decks will get explosive from time to time, but they don't really have those game-breaking plays that come out of nowhere with overly powered cards. But I would believe that some of my most powerful decks, I do have a Queen Marchesa Aristocrats deck that if I am able to get Purphoros, God of the Forge, and Corpse Knight out, for instance, I can create a whole bunch of tokens and, you know, do 20, 30 damage right off the bat to everyone else at the table. So that has happened a couple of times with that deck where I'm able to take something that's a little bit out of the ordinary for a standard Aristocrats deck and just pummel people out of nowhere. So, unfortunately, that deck's kind of gotten banned from my playgroup because it was too powerful, so I don't get to play it an awful lot, but it definitely has that potential. I wouldn't consider that that's something it does all the time because it's not really meant to do that. It's kind of like a plan B in the deck, but it has definitely saved my bacon more than once in this form.
Yeah, and I mean, when we're talking about bombs aren't all the same, aren't going to all be the same flavor, and even your explosions and your implosions are going to be to varying degrees, right?
Mm-hmm.
The type of, like, if you think about the real world example, right, the type of bomb that it's going to take to, let's say, you know, implode a building that's under demolition is not the same as the type of bomb that you're going to need to implode, like, you know, a bag of air, right? They're
mm-hmm.
going to be fundamentally different in terms of their magnitude and in terms of sort of what they're hoping to accomplish. So I think that when we talk about these bomb type decks, we're just talking about that. So your deck has that sort of potential to do that.
Okay, yeah, that does make a lot of sense. I haven't really built that deck to have that explosive turn, but it has done that before in the past, hence why I can never play it these days with my local playgroup, which is unfortunate, but I kind of expect that with the way that we play. So I just wanted to quickly ask if you have a really good example of an implosion deck. Obviously, we've been talking about the explosion, but I'm just curious to hear your thoughts on what you consider more of an implosive deck.
Well, I would actually consider Flibblethip to be more of an implosion type deck, because if someone manages to do something like, in this case, destroy that that Mirror of Fate before I'm able to crack it off, or it gets milled out or whatever, that deck, the only other way that it can really win is there are a few really large, you know, like random Leviathan beaters.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, the deck is just going to draw a really, really long game. And if it's going to win, it's going to win with something like doing Jace Wielder of Mysteries, drawing the last card the old-fashioned way,
mm-hmm.
by casting cards that just draw one or two cards at a time. So it tends to be very, very slow and drudgy if it doesn't manage to pull that off. So I consider that more of a glass cannon than more of an implosion than an explosion.
Yeah,
an explosion for me would be more like your traditional landfall decks, right? Where they're not necessarily comboing out, but there's just so much consistency in the types of cards that are incorporated in those decks,
mm-hmm.
that you go from a board state in which you might have three or four lands on the battlefield to, over the course of a couple turns, having, you know, 50 elementals and 900 lands because you're playing a 1,000 card deck or whatever, and you somehow manage to, you know, pull these incredible board states over a very short period of time. And even after removing key pieces, you still see that presence is very clear. In fact, in the latest Game Nights episode that we saw, right? That the deck that was played by, what's his name, Keith?
Yeah.
The deck that was played by Keith, that's a great example of an explosive deck. He managed to set up, over the course of a couple turns, a nice sort of foundation, and then he just shot far ahead, and he just stayed there until the end of the game.
Mm-hmm. And that's definitely a great example of being able to just set up those value engines. Definitely something that Simic is great at doing on its own, especially with the new four-color Omnath Jellybean tribal thing. That card is just extremely gross, and it vomits value.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
It's just that, Tatiova, AC, Tyrant of Gyrostrate, just the cards that reward you for playing the game, and then, you know, they're good on just the basic level, but then if you kick them up a notch to a higher powered meta, they get just so gross so quickly.
Yeah, I mean, you could even argue something as simple as you can even see these types of decks in something like mono white, because mm-hmm. there are a few cards in mono white that will dump a bunch of resources on the board simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
And if you manage to get in that state where all of a sudden you have all of these resources, and especially something like white, you can prohibit people from using their resources, and mm-hmm. you disproportionately have just this huge leverage over the table because you're so far ahead in what you're able to do and the rest of the table's not.
Mm-hmm. Especially since white's great at those kinds of taxing effects. Obviously, if you take it to the extreme, you could go into the stacks, mono-white stacks effects. But yes, you can have the ability to at least slow the rest of the table down to be able to continue building your value engine, because otherwise you're probably going about it a little bit slower than the rest of the table. You don't have as many benefits of mono white as the other colors, but again, we've beaten that into the ground, or at least the discourse has beaten that into the ground. Mono white is still a very good way to play. It's just it takes some getting used to, and it's challenging, and I think that's why it's ultimately interesting to play. But anyway, that's neither here nor there now.
Yes.
So, going to the next one here, could you explain a little bit more about electioneering and what that entails?
So, electioneering, it's called electioneering because I needed something that started with an E.
Yes, makes sense. I have to say, I love this this acronym right here. It just fits you to a T so well.
Thank you. But these are going to be your typical politics type decks,
mm-hmm.
right? We know the big ones, right? You have Marchesa, Mardu Marchesa tends to be a very much a political deck.
Mm-hmm.
You have things like Zansha can be built in a very political way.
Yep, I used to have a deck with her as the commander. It sucked, but that's beside the point.
Kyros and Tirno, they are also typically built as a politics type deck.
Mm-hmm.
We don't usually consider group hug as a political strategy, but really it is, right? Because what you're doing is you're creating a state in which the rest of the table doesn't want to take, is disincentivized from doing things to you because they're getting resources from you indirectly or directly. So when I think of politics decks, I tend to think of them as sort of being in three major groups. One, you have your traditional group hug decks where you're giving everyone advantages, and presumably you've built your deck so that you can just leverage them a little bit better than everyone else. Things like Flourishing Rights, right? Every player gets to draw an extra card and play an extra land. Well, if you're playing Flourishing Rights and you happen to be playing like Burgeoning, well, guess what? You're getting several land drops more than everyone else.
Oh yeah, same thing with like Howling Mine. Even something as weird as Temple Bell, which allows everyone to draw a card for just a tap effect. Yeah, just those typical kinds of group huggy pillow fort type things that sort of. I mean, I'm kind of going off the rails there, but yeah, the group hug strategies that really annoy some people and make other people very happy to have you at the table.
Right. I have what I call my nice slivers deck. It only has slivers that have never been reprinted in paper.
Oh, interesting.
So there happen to be 69 of those slivers. It's playing all 69 of them and 31 lands, hence nice slivers.
Oh, weird. That's actually the first time I've ever heard someone say that they have a fair slivers deck. Having a very unfair slivers deck in my meta that I've effectively had to get taken out of our format because we just can't compete with it in the local meta here. But yeah, it's funny.
I will say certainly that there is one card that if it ever got reprinted, that deck would be incapable of doing anything. there's a sliver that gives the ability to all the slivers to sacrifice to generate 2 black mana. And when Sliver Queen happens to be your commander,
that results in some
really interesting things that people really hate because it comes out of nowhere and you're like, oh, well, sorry, I didn't mean to infinitely combo. It just kind of happened. Like, legitimately just happened. I'm sorry. I know it's slivers. I should have expected that, but I really didn't expect it.
Oh, yeah, that definitely happens sometimes. It's that weird eureka moment where it's like, hey, this deck just turned in from a kind of a weird janky thing to a bomb all of a sudden. All of a sudden I'm having this hugely explosive turn that I had no idea this could even do. Yeah, that's always an interesting sensation when that happens.
So you have those group hug decks, and then you have what... So I think people tend to call them group slug decks. I don't like thinking about them like that. I like thinking of them as sort of mutual destruction.
Okay.
Right, so what you're doing is instead of giving everyone resources, what you're doing is you're sort of playing the sheriff, in that you're playing cards that are going to penalize players for being greedy with things like mana or card draw. So a really good example of this is the card Spiteful Visions. Okay, every player gets to draw an extra card, and whenever a player draws a card, they lose one life.
Okay, that's interesting.
So you're giving everyone an extra card, so they're going to be losing two life every draw step anyway. And then on top of that, if they happen to play, you know, a Blue Sun Zenith for 40, well, they're doming themselves for 40 because they're going to be taking a damage. They're going to be losing a life for each time that they happen to draw an extra card.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So it's essentially saying I'm going to let you draw these extra cards. Go ahead and do that. But if you do that, know that there are consequences for it. So I actually have a deck, my Xantcha deck, because I have a Xantcha deck because why wouldn't I have one?
Yeah. She's become really popular ever since she was played on that episode of Game Nights 9, 10, maybe a year, months ago, maybe a year ago or something, where that deck did a lot of work. I've noticed a lot more of those decks out there on EDH Rec, especially since when I used to have my deck, which was atrocious. Again, I will say that. I will admit to that one. but yeah, the price increase on her has definitely shown that she's a pretty popular card, whether or not she's in the 99 or your commander. It's just a good, solid value card.
Oh, for sure. I mean, she's a little clunky to build with because you have to remember that you're giving her to an opponent. But the way that I built her is I call her Xanchantress because it's primarily it's primarily an enchantment based deck, and what the deck does is the deck basically punishes everyone for being greedy. So it plays things like it plays some really gross cards. It plays Mana Barbs.
Oh.
It plays Spiteful Visions. It plays Sulfuric Vortex.
Oh, that is gross, but I love things, it at the same time.
things like Citadel of Pain, Price of Glory. Essentially, the deck says, you can play this game. That is fine. But know that any time that you want to cast a really big spell, or you want to draw extra cards, or you want to play things at instant speed on someone else's turn, know that you're going to be losing life for it.
Mm-hmm. Nice symmetrical effect right there to make sure people stay in line without, and also be able to kind of keep the rest of the table in check. That definitely sounds like the kind of Azorius way to build here, but you're doing it in the colors that don't seem to want to do that. So that's a really interesting concept.
Yeah, I mean, funny thing, I've essentially labeled it as sort of the you're gonna play fair deck. I actually had Dockside Extortionist in the deck, but I'm taking it out for Treasure Nabber because it's more on flavor with the idea of what Xantra's trying to do.
Oh yeah, that's a much better fit than not saying Dockside Extortionist is not a good card. That is a completely other discussion. But yeah, no. Treasure Nabber just works so well in that situation because you can just take someone's artifact and use it, then give it back to them. It's just gross value is what it is.
Yeah, it's like you want to use that soul ring, go ahead, you can use it, but I'm going to use it next turn. So just be aware that that's what's going to happen. That deck doesn't tend to win very often because it is, again, sort of just playing this enforcement, more of this enforcement style, but that's fine because that's not really what the deck is about. The deck is about just it's a very fast deck because its goal is to just basically deal as much damage as it possibly can across the board. And also it is constructed in a way that makes it so that people aren't doing things like taking 20 minute turns, because yeah, you can do that, but know that you're going to be taking extra damage every time you cast a spell. You're going to be taking extra damage for dropping extra lands. You're going to be taking damage for drawing cards. Like, sure, yes, you can play your four-color Omnath, but you're also going to be taking a whole lot of damage. Oh, yeah, and they're Sulfuric Vortex, so you're not gaining life either. So have fun, I guess.
Yeah, that's definitely one of those ways to be able to keep people down and kind of keep things fair. So the last category on here you called "I didn't do it." I'm just really curious to know what exactly you mean by that. That it's interesting.
So what the inspiration for this was actually that Sheldon Mennery has a deck. I've never actually seen the deck, but I've heard about the deck and I've heard about the types of cards that are in it, and I'm incredibly just in love with the concept. So think of the card Deflecting Palm. Okay, you attack someone and then in response that damage is reflected back onto you, or something like Brash Taunter, or something like Stuffy Doll, right? This idea that you're aggressing, and in the process of aggressing you're actually having the damage dealt back to you. Well, that's essentially saying, I didn't actually do this, you to yourself, I didn't anything. Right, I'm just sitting here trying to play my game, and in the process you've dealt yourself 15 damage because you decided that I was a threat.
Yeah, it's definitely powerful to be able to have something like that. We have a player in my meta locally who has the Naeth of the Dire Hunt Fight Club thing going on with one of his decks, and he has definitely beat the crap out of the other players. And I'm using Brash Taunter and Stuffy Doll on that deck, just using the fight mechanic specifically, but yeah, just effects like that that redirect damage and just do crazy, funky things.
Yeah, another example of this is actually I have a little bit of this I didn't do it built into that Xantra deck that I was talking about. So there's a card called Destructive Urge from Urza's Legacy. Urza's Gears. Urza's Saga.
Okay.
It's 1 and 2 red. It's an enchant aura. And it says, whenever enchanted creature successfully deals combat damage to a player, that player sacrifices a land. So you slap this on Xantia, and all of a sudden this guy, whoever you gave Xantia to, now has to go and attack someone else that's not you. When Xantia connects and deals damage, the person that they attacked has to sacrifice a land now.
Hmm.
You didn't do it. You just gave them a Xantia, and you just tacked on an aura. That's the person that did the aggressing, though. That wasn't you. That was someone else.
Mm-hmm. Definitely so seems that's to fit kinda, now.
So that's what I kind of think about in terms of this, I didn't do it. It's sort of deflecting the blame onto someone else, even though you may have sort of set up the situation. You're ultimately not the one who, you know, you didn't give the final push, so you can truthfully still say, I didn't really do it, this other person kind of did.
Mm-hmm. Definitely seems like an interesting concept to be able to include this in someone's, or at least in one of your decks anyway, so that's, it's an interesting take on this whole strategy, but not looking at it like group hug versus group slug versus kind of a stop hitting yourself thing, whereas you have it more as these fall under a single category, sort of, but you can still take some liberties with the way you build the decks to try to make them a bit more accessible, I suppose, to the everyday player versus just saying, this is group hug, this is group slug, they have nothing in common.
Yeah, I think that so any real good group hug deck, right, has to have a group hug deck that's capable of actually winning has to be able to do something, mm-hmm. right? It has to leverage the advantages that it's giving the opponents in a way that it can ultimately get their life down to zero. It can deal the 21 the 21 commander damage, mm-hmm. 10 infect, whatever it is. They have to be able to deal that finishing blow in some way, shape, or form. At the very least for that last person. Okay? So even a very common thing in a group hug deck is to include something like Psychosis Crawler so that you can deal a bunch of damage to your opponents as they're all drawing a bunch of cards and you're drawing a bunch of cards.
Mm-hmm.
Would you consider that group hug?
Traditionally, probably not.
Right, you would consider that more of this sort of group slug thing. But in the end, what we're talking about is we're talking about different flavors of politics, right? And the question is, are you being agonistic, right? Are you mm-hmm. supporting the rest of the table? Are you being antagonistic? Are you trying to just get life totals down as low as possible? And where are you, and are you taking the blame for that? That's really the axes that we're talking about when we're talking about this electioneering or politics. We're talking about, are you actively getting the life totals down, or are you building the other players up? Are you taking the other players down? And how much of that blame are you taking personally?
That's
right, because as a group hug player, usually what happens is a group hug player will play a bunch of things that will increase the resources for all the players at the table, or maybe one of the other players at the table. And then what usually ends up happening is that as the first and second players are taken out of the game, it becomes apparent that group hug player has actually been, you know, pulling strings behind the scenes, making sure that, you know, oh, well, I made sure that Slivers deck had access to those extra lands that they needed in order to, you know, replay their commander for the third or fourth time. Or I made sure as the group hug player, I made sure that you drew enough cards so that you could pitch them to Tectonic Reformation and draw more cards and do whatever it is. You end up with the situation where you find out that the group hug player all along has just been this person just sitting in the back sort of watching the puppets dance as they're giving all these resources.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not until you've eliminated the first or maybe the second player that you're like, oh wow, you know what? This person has actually been the threat the entire time and we just didn't see it. And somehow every single time players forget this.
Yeah, I haven't run into a whole lot of group hug decks in the wild. I mean, I haven't played as much VDH as I would like to. But, yeah, that's definitely one of those things where, in some cases, you even know what's happening, and there's sometimes you just don't care because you're getting extra cards. If you're getting land screwed, or, you know, you're just not drawing the things you need, it's nice to draw those extra cards, even though you know in the back of your mind that they're trying to manipulate you like a puppet. So, yeah, it's interesting to see how those decks play out sometimes.
Just one more thing very quickly.
Yeah,
sure. The Xantcha deck, I said, it typically doesn't win. It doesn't. But every time that my playgroup sees it, they know that the game is going to be fast, because they know that everyone's going to be taking 4 or 5 damage every turn. So we're going to be playing 6, 7, 8 turns maybe, and they also know that there are a few pieces that they absolutely have to get rid of. But for the most part, I can just lay low. And this deck only runs 18 creatures.
Mm.
And most of them are very large creatures that you have to pay like 4, 5, 6 mana for. And I can get away with that small number of creatures because I can just drop enchantments and people are like, well, that's not doing anything. Well, that's not really doing anything. Well, that's not really doing anything. While I'm just sitting there pinging away at them like one life at a time. And they know that they're losing life, but they don't care because, again, as they see it, the game is just going faster, and that's okay. So this has actually kind of been constructed that way so that you can sort of lay low enough but still be doing that damage. And in that sense, it's very political, because I can sit there and say, I don't have any creatures on board. Why are you attacking me? I can't do anything. All I'm doing is sitting here making sure that guy can't gain life. That's all I'm doing right now.
Yeah, so I think that leads us into the next bit of the acronym here. So A for aggressive, and I'm assuming that this kind of falls more in the line of the traditional aggro deck where you're trying to drop as many creatures, do as much damage as possible, burn, things like that.
Yeah, so aggressive in this case is not just aggro, right? Because when we talk about aggro, we're talking traditionally about sort of those windshield wiper decks, right? You play your creatures, you turn them sideways, and then you untap them, you turn them sideways, and so on and so forth, right? Sort of back and forth.
It's a great analogy.
That's part of this. But I think when we're talking about aggressive, we're really talking about, again, what are you doing? Are you eating away at your opponent's life points? Or life points, this isn't Yu-Gi-Oh! At your opponent's life.
Well, it can be, right? If you want it to be, but
it can be Yu-Gi-Oh! Same thing, right?
I guess they're equally confusing nowadays, so there's definitely that.
So in aggressive here, I sort of created two categories, like the more traditional windshield wiper approach, the aggro approach, and then so I called it the "this is fine" meme. You know, the dog sipping his coffee saying "this is
mm-hmm,
fine,"
mm-hmm.
Where you're just playing cards that just deal a bunch of damage to everyone. Classic example is something like Havoc Festival.
Okay, yeah. Right?
Havoc Festival is a card that you drop it and everyone starts losing half their life. Like, that's just what happens. That's a very aggressive card. It costs 1,000 mana, but it's an aggressive card.
Yeah.
And people see it, and a good way to identify sort of an aggressive card is if I drop the card, does everyone's eyes sort of jump to it and say, if that's not gone in the next 3 turns, we're all basically dead.
Mm-hmm.
Something that is that large of a threat that immediately draws everyone's eyes and they say, oh man, this has got to go now, probably indicates that we're talking about something that is aggressive.
Yeah, definitely reminds me of some of the somewhat bad beats I've had. I've run into the card that seems to resonate me most in this category is definitely Jyn Gitaxis. I've had some really bad experiences with that one because it comes out, it wrecks your plans. Even if you're not drawing cards, it just wrecks everything. And, you know, it may not take that many turns, or it could take a long time, but once it's out on the table, everyone understands you gotta kill that or you don't have any cards anymore. It's just that powerful.
Yeah, so I kind of struggled with this because as I was trying to figure out how to sort of describe this is fine category, One of the things that I sort of butted into, and you mentioned it here when you mentioned Jyn Gataxus, is I said in the show notes that you see, I said that it's you're playing cards that deal massive amounts of damage to everyone, but really we should probably conceptualize it more as you're dealing massive amounts, you're messing with people's resources in a way that make them unable to progress forward. And in that sense, something like a Stax deck could actually be considered an aggressive deck, which is not something that most people would think of immediately. But think about what a good Stax deck is doing, if there is such a thing as a good Stax deck. A good Stax deck is saying, I'm going to play the game, and none of you are going to play the game. I'm going to sit here, and I'm going to destroy your life while there's nothing that you can do about it. That's a good Stax deck.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a very aggressive thing to do. You're holding people down, and you're poking them in the forehead. Even if it's, you know, with a 2-2 flyer, it doesn't matter. You're aggressing on them in a way that they're unable to do anything about it.
So is it fair to say that we could define this as not necessarily dealing massive amounts of damage, but dealing massive amounts of disadvantage to your opponents?
We could probably say that, yeah. I would probably talk about it in terms of resources than I would necessarily advantage. I guess that's really a pedantic distinction, but because I think what we're talking about is because damage is like your life is a resource like everything else is, right? So an aggressive deck would be one that has a bunch of one-sided board wipes, right? Or you're playing Indestructible Tribal and things like Blasphemous Act, right? That would be an example of a very aggressive deck, because you're making sure that other people can't do things while you are chipping away at them. So yeah, I disadvantaged everyone else. I could agree with that.
Yeah, so do you have a really good example of a deck that would fit under this category that you want to discuss a little bit?
So for the former example, the Windshield Wiper, like a lot of players, I have just a dumb mono green deck. It's Kodama of the North Tree, which is one of those Kodamas that no one plays because he has Shroud. But it's a deck where you play a bunch of, this is green spirits. So you play green spirits, you play them, you turn them sideways, and you basically just keep smashing in as you're going along. Another example would be something like, I have a Gerard Weatherlight Captain deck. Deck. It's Phoenix Tribal.
Okay.
So in the early game, it's dropping, you know, a bunch of flying firebirds and doing your more traditional type of aggression, smashing in for 2 and 3 here and there. And they're flyers, so a lot of people are just like, well, I can't do anything about that, you know. It has a good number of board wipes in it to make sure that I can, you know, keep everyone else in check. And while I'm keeping them in check, my Phoenixes, most of them have recursion abilities of some sort, so I can bring a lot of them back just natively. And then Gerard's able to bring a lot of them back with his ability. And later on in the game, the aggression sort of takes the form, sort of shifts from this sort of Windshield Wiper approach to being more of a burn type style with something like Flare of the Hatebound, which is a devil originally in, I think, Innistrad. It's 5 and a red. It has Undying, and it says whenever Flare of the Hatebound or another creature enters the battlefield from your graveyard, that creature deals damage equal to its power to any target.
Interesting.
So with all of these Phoenixes coming back from the graveyard, or Gerard bringing all of my creatures back from the graveyard at the same time, you get a couple sack outlets in there, and all of a sudden you're doming people for 4, 5 at a time. So it sort of shifts from that sort of aggressive attacking to sort of a more aggressive burning type style.
Yeah, that's definitely an interesting way to do that, because again, you're just doing the standard Warstorm, Surge, Terror of the Peaks when you play a creature, but it has that interesting ability where you can just bring them all back. So you have some flexibility with how you build some board wipes into that deck too, because you don't really have to care about your creatures dying, because you have a way to be able to recur them, and then you can still dome people when you're able to do the thing that your deck wants to do already.
Yeah, traditionally when people do this type of strategy, they do things like include War Storm Surge or Impact Tremors. I specifically didn't include them in the deck because I wanted to keep it to this sort of leaning into this recursion ability. So when the things leave the graveyard, you have the Flayer triggers, and then there's another there's an artifact from M19 called Desecrated Tomb. Uh-huh. When one or more creature cards leave your graveyard, you create a 1/1 black bat creature token with flying. So instead of those Flayer triggers, you could just make yourself a bunch more flyers, and if you have enough of those flyers, you're just gonna be it doesn't matter what they have, right? You're just gonna be able to run them over with a bunch of bats. Like, who sees that coming?
Definitely not in a red deck. You're not gonna typically see that kind of card. So that's a really interesting combination of cards right there. I guess I never really thought of Desecrated Tomb as being a red or being involved in a red deck of any kind, but that's a really interesting synergy right there. I like it.
Yeah, I think it really only works because of the recursion that you have available in the white. Mm-hmm. Right? Because Gerard is able to bring things back. That's very much his the white part of his identity. There are other cards that'll bring stuff back from the graveyard, like we have Squeeze him. That doesn't bring him back to the battlefield. You have like Gift of Immortality is in there because that combos with Gerard. Obviously, you have things like Face Reward.
Yep.
Luminous Brood Moth. It doesn't work with the Phoenixes, but it works with the Devil with the Flayer. So you can sort of loop those if you wanted to. I mean, there's a lot of really cool stuff that you can do in, you know, Boros or in red or in white if you sort of look around the color spectrum. Because again, right, red, it does have that recursion. It has those phoenixes, right? There's not a lot of good ones, but they're there, and you can find a way to sort of make them work.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I really love about the format in general, is you don't have to play the most powerful cards. You can find a use for pretty much everything somewhere in the right deck.
Definitely.
Okay, I wanted to take a quick break to remind everyone that you're listening to the MTG in Quarantine podcast. My name's MJ, I'm your host tonight, and on the show I have Raphael, aka Ursa Bearwalker. And we're talking about decks in your stable, specifically the BEARS acronym for Bomb, Electioneering, Aggressive, Restricted, and Safe. And we are now going to shift over to the Restricted section. This sounds like something that maybe we shouldn't be touching, but since it's restricted, but I mean, how would you define restricted in this acronym specifically?
So I think that these last two categories are probably the easiest for players to wrap their head around, because restricted, we'll start with restricted.
Okay.
So when we're talking about restrictions, a restricted deck, we're just talking about a deck that has some sort of restriction in mind.
Okay.
The most common one that we know of is like, okay, well, I have a budget restriction.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Like, I'm going to build a $100 deck, or I'm going to build a deck under $25 or something. Yep. No card's going to be over a dollar, whatever. So that's a very common way that we sort of think about building with a restriction. And why I think that you should have this restricted deck in your stable is because allows you to, one, explore cards that you wouldn't necessarily play otherwise and see how they actually interact in the wild, and two, I think it creates for more interesting moments in games. Example, so you have your budget decks, but then you also have things like a theme deck. Okay, chair tribal, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. That's cool. Themes can be things as simple as you're building around a mechanic. So Dana Roach from CMDR Central,
yep.
he has a Death Touch tribal deck. All the cards in there, all the creatures in there have Death Touch. So like, that's an example of building around a mechanic. But you can also sort of build it with more of a flavor in mind. So the example being like chair tribal or people wearing hats, things like that. Okay.
Uh-huh. Or your major theme, or for like franchise things, like some people have their Lord of the Rings deck or other franchises that are really popular, and they try to find some analogs to that, or let's say the example that always comes to me, like the Weatherlight crew, the original one, some people will just be able to throw together at least a somewhat playable deck of all the main characters from the old time sagas there. And I mean, if the deck isn't that great, that's not the point. The point is you're building the theme because you want to have something unique, and that's A-okay, even if the power level is not, you know, what most people would consider great.
Exactly. This also includes things like building within the same block or the same plane, mm-hmm. right? Like, I have a friend who has, he has a Psy deck that is Kaladesh Tribal.
Okay.
So all the cards have to feature art that on Kaladesh. So it's essentially restricted to Origins, the Kaladesh block, and then, like, the couple of random cards that have been printed in, like, Commander sets since then. And then we have what I like to refer to as a deprivation deck. This is going to be a deck where you sort of build without a particular card type in mind, or you build exclusively with a particular card type. Like a Nikia of the Old Ways deck.
Okay, yeah, that's a great example.
Because she specifically says on the actual card itself, it says that you can't cast non-creature spells. So those decks tend to run very few, if any, non-creature spells.
Mm-hmm.
And a personal challenge that you can have is to build a Nikia deck that has only creatures in it. And that would be an example of sort of this deprivation build, because you're not including artifacts, you're not including enchantments, everything is on a body.
So you're going to be playing a lot of the Reclamation Sage type effects, the Enter the Battlefields, Thrag Tusk, things like that to get all the value, because you're not playing all the mana rocks, because you're getting all the value off your commander, so you're able to build around that, even though it would look like on the face you're actually making the deck weaker, you're actually sticking to that theme and giving yourself the extra mana you need to be able to pull through in the mid and late game.
Right, and because of that, those Nikia decks include cards that you don't usually see in other Gruul decks, because it's a particular effect that's now on a body instead of being on an artifact or being on an enchantment.
Mm-hmm. Someone like even Fertilid, for example, is you're probably more likely to see in that deck, because you can, so if you can find a way to manipulate the counters, or even if you can't, you can still get a couple of rampant growth effects out of that for a little bit more mana, but you're able to save the card slot instead of having a sorcery by having the body out there, and you're able to more easily cast that card and do whatever shenanigans you need to with that card specifically in that sort of deck, or Wood Elves for that instance.
Exactly. I mean, If you look on EDH Rec, it says that the average Nikia deck has 57 creatures in it, which is insane for any other deck.
It right, might be the most of any commander. I think the EDH Rec guys had on their podcast a week or two ago, had the most creatures or something, kind of the most of episode and least of on there. And I believe Nikia was probably number one on that list for number of creatures running in that deck.
I believe that that is true. Yes. So something like, speaking of bears, okay, Ulvenwald Tracker, mm-hmm. right? it's a creature that has a fight ability stapled onto it. Now, that's not a thing that you would see running in most decks,
mm-hmm.
because most decks would say, if I want a fight effect, I'm not going to wait a turn so that my creature can then tap and then I can activate the ability. I'm just going to play a fight card. But because Nikia specifies you can't cast non-creature spells, you say, okay, what creature has a fight ability stapled onto it? Well, Ulvenwald Tracker does. Let's go ahead and include that, and I can use that as my targeted removal after it's been on the table for a turn, or I've given it haste.
Mm-hmm. Or even something like Gargos Vicious Watcher works well, or even Naeth, mm-hmm. is that you're able to get that green specific fight effect on the creature bodies and be able to have it available whenever you need it, instead of playing something like Rabid Bite or something, which you play it once, it's gone to the graveyard, you're probably not going to get it back because you're playing mono green.
Exactly.
Or even Gruul. You just struggle to get cards back from the graveyards from your graveyard in those colors, so it just makes a lot more sense to be able to have the repeatable on a stick effect. That makes a lot of sense.
Yep, and what's really nice about these restricted decks is because we're talking about being restricted in various domains, right? You're restricting based on budget, on theme, depriving yourself of particular types of cards, or some combination of these three.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're restricting the deck, you are, one, you're capping the power level, because you're not saying, I want to run the most optimal card in that card slot. you're saying, I want to run a card that best fits whatever these constraints that I placed on myself are. Mm-hmm. In my experience, power level seems to correlate with, I don't want to say it correlates with fun, but it kind of, in my experience, it seems to correlate with fun. Playing super powerful decks can be fun, but if all that, at least for me and the type of player that I am, if everyone is playing their strongest deck all the time or playing near CEDH all the time, I'm not going to be having fun. Because the type of player that I am, at least, I like seeing these random cards that no one has seen in like 20, like no one has put in a deck ever, or it's on like three decks in EDH rec or whatever, and someone plays it and you're like, wow, I cannot believe you played that random common from the dark and it did this insane thing with your commander because mm-hmm. you had these three other cards out. That is a hell of a story. And I know now, next time, I need to look out for that and start keeping people on their toes. That's the kind of gameplay that I like to see. I'm not going to bash anyone for playing CEDH or near CEDH, but I tried, and it's just not the way that I like to play Magic.
Yeah, so that's why I basically kind of had to put my Marchesa deck away, and really kind of goes what into how I build my deck specifically. I feel like a lot of mine go in the restricted category, because I do try to find cards that, again, no one's ever really heard of before, or you haven't seen played in that way. I'm always on the lookout for interesting commanders who give you a nice little edge, or some weird, unplayable, seemingly unplayable common that has a big blowout effect in the right circumstance, and just those kind of once-in-a-while plays that it can have an explosion, that bomb-type moment. And I feel like those are always situations where people will remember that play specifically when they think about the game. If you play at the higher power levels, and I talked about this on one of my episodes recently on the channel, is that you're not always going to remember the games you played at the higher power levels because, you know, the play lines are a lot more optimized in those games. Mm. A lot of people are doing the same sorts of things. You're going to see a lot of the same commanders, same play lines, etc. But if you're playing with what, at least how I define jank, being something that's less than optimal but is still very creative in its own right, you can still have the memorable plays, the magical Christmas land, if it were, and you can definitely remember those plays because you don't see them every day.
Yeah, and I mean, like, I say restricted, and there are varying degrees of restricted. So, like, I talked about my Zanchet. So I'm going to touch on a point here that I was going to save it for the end, but I'm going to touch on it here now. Presenting these different categories, it's not like one deck fits into one category and only one category. Mm-hmm. So like my Zanchet deck started out as a restricted budget deck. It started out as I think it started as $100 deck. And then we upped the budget a little bit. My playgroup and I upped the budget like $10 or something like that every week or every month until, you know, we eventually stopped. And then I added some other cards to it. But it originally started as a budget deck and has now sort of moved away from that. But it's still very heavy in terms of its theme. Its theme is making sure that it's enforcing rules of the table and making sure that people are playing fair Magic. So the deck itself only has one instant and one artifact in it.
Interesting.
The instant is Price of Progress because you need to penalize people for being greedy with their mana bases. And the artifact, and half the time I play it at sorcery speed, so it doesn't matter. And the artifact in the deck is Isolation Cell, which is an artifact for, which is an artifact for four that says whenever an opponent casts a creature spell, that player loses two life unless he or she pays two. And the reason that that is in the deck is because that's another one of these cases where we're saying, yes, you can cast creatures, but you're going to lose life for it. Or you're going to pay mana for it. I'm going to make sure that you're not just sitting there chew-laning out and spamming 55 creatures at a time.
Okay. No one likes that, really. I mean, it's some people do, but that, yeah, those Chulain decks, man, those get gross so quickly.
But I thought about cutting both of these cards, but I said that, you know, they fit the flavor theme of the deck, even though they sort of deviate from the deprivation end of the deck. The deck originally had no artifacts in it and had no instants in it, and that was done intentionally because I said I want this deck to play at sorcery speed and I want it to do its effects with enchantments. Mm-hmm. And I've only started to fudge the boundaries a little bit because the flavor fits so much better than the deprivation did. And yeah. I kind of do this restriction with all of my decks because I have another deck that's purely a theme deck. It's called my Shirtless Bear Fighter deck.
Oh, that's interesting.
It has Surok Dragonclaw as the commander. Uh-huh. And all of the cards in the deck either have a bear in the art or a shirtless person in the art, or there's some sort of fight card.
Okay.
So you have things like Flaxen Intruder, which can make a bunch of bears. That seems fine. You have things like Uvenwald Tracker, which I already talked about. There's mm-hmm. a bear in the background there. You also have some fun things like there's a version of Winter's Grasp, which is a sorcery that no one knows about. This one is the one printed in Portals. It's 1/2 green, and it says destroy any one land. So it's land destruction in green. But it's in here because in the corner, right there, bottom left-hand corner, you have a bear.
Sounds like someone's been kind of subscribing to the same train as a Graham Stark over on LRR with that theme. But again, kind of taking it a step further, that you're not just doing a bear theme. You're kind of saying, I want the bear to be included, but I'm also not doing standard just bear tribal. I'm doing something completely different.
Yeah, when I started to build the deck, I was actually reading it was a short comic series that was actually called Shirtless Bear Fighter. It was about a guy who was raised by bears and he would fight them like shirtless. And it's a totally raunchy comic book. I don't recommend it to anyone unless that's your thing. But I said, I'm going to build myself a deck. I'm going to build myself a bear deck because bears are sort of iconic creatures in Magic. And I said, well, how am I going to do this? So I did it by saying I'm going to lean into this shirtless bear fighter thing. Originally, it was very, very heavy on the bears. I've since had to, for logistical reasons, back off and say I'm going to include a couple more shirtless cards because, like, you're not running things like Rampant Growth because, as far as I know, there's no art of Rampant Growth that includes a shirtless person or a bear or a fight of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to slot things in instead, like Beast Caller Savant, which is a mana dork of a shirtless elf, right?
Yep.
So things like that, like just accommodations like that. Not enough card draw, so I slapped in a greater good, even though that's not really going to do a whole lot of good when I'm sacrificing a 2/2 and then discarding 3 cards. But, you know, it's card draw.
Yeah,
it's card draw, and the guy's shirtless on it. Yeah. So it's included, too.
Wouldn't, like, Return of the Wild Speaker come out in that deck, sort of, being overly powerful 2?
That's in there too, yeah.
Okay, yeah. I was gonna say that's just like the quintessential card with that art. It worked perfectly in that deck, and also because it's just a really good card in general.
Yeah, the iffiest card in that deck is I have an Ixodron included,
mm-hmm.
and the justification that I put for that is, well, Ixodron's not wearing a shirt, and he makes all the creatures 2/2s. So let's just go ahead and say that's good enough.
Yeah, I'm not really sure what Ixodron is supposed to be, but yeah, that's an interesting interesting card to include in that. So just wanted to shift gears here over to the last category. Yep. Safe. Curious to know, does this only include pre-cons or just any kind of deck that's sort of meant to keep things simple? You mentioned in your notes that it's kind of a deck that a new player could easily play with or against. And again, the precons are typically meant for something like this, and with, you know, the core sets having all the reminder text, most of the time anyway. Would you consider this like a precon level or just a dexy where you really have an uber restrictive theme in some cases to try to make it fairly simple?
So precons would definitely be included within this umbrella, but I think that you also have things like decks that are relatively straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of the Windshield Wiper decks would also fall under the safe umbrella because it's, you know, you cast a spell, it's a creature, you're attacking with it, the end. I think that decks that have a lot of very obvious synergy would also be included. So I think to some extent, landfall decks could go under a safe category if it was built in a particular way. But I think that the decks that you're not going to see in the safe category are going to be things like decks that involve tutoring out combos, because unless you're very familiar with the deck and how it's going to go about actually executing and protecting that combo, you're not really going to know what you're doing. So I think that the safe decks are going to... I mean, we kind of see this to some extent with the precons, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even the more Tinker Toy precons are still very direct. Like something like Aminatu. The Aminatu deck was constructed with the blink effects in mind. And sort of leaning into that strategy. But at the same time, it very much made sure that what you were blinking was pretty obvious, and it wasn't doing things like, okay, I'm going to have it so that you blink this card, which will then blink all of the other cards that you have out, and then you'll double all your ETBs, and oh look, there's a Panharmonicon in it. Like it wasn't anything like that, to where it was, you, in order to win, you had to have these four or five cards out in this combination in order to win.
Mm-hmm.
Or like in that same year, you had the Estrid deck.
Yep.
That was a very powerful precon, incredibly powerful. Especially if you pulled out what was that enchantment creature, the one that doubles the power of a creature, you could sit there and dome someone for like 64 with the sealed precon. You would just bash them in for a whole bunch of damage, but that was a very easy to understand deck because it was, okay, you're playing lands, you're going to ramp with your aura ramps, you're going to ramp with a couple of artifact ramps, sure, but you're going to lean into these auras. You're going to play auras, you're going to try to maximize that value as much as possible. And even the second and third commanders in that deck leaned into the aura strategy fairly obviously. So that you could basically pick it up and say, okay, this is auras. You thumb through the cards, you say, I got it. And you could play it, and you'd be fine.
Mm-hmm. Especially if you play, like, Tuvasa, which is in there where you're just drawing cards off of that. It's just overly powerful when you're not quite sure what to do and you just pick up a deck or, you know, a friend hands you a deck. If it just says, do this, draw a card, that is probably one of the easiest lines to play. Again, I consider... Tatiova kind of in the same way, is that you can build it very powerfully, but you don't have to. You can build it in a very simple way where it's just play land, even if you're just getting one land a turn, play land, draw a card, very simple. The Joyra Weather like Captain deck that I have, which is nowhere near optimized, is kind of built in the same vein where it's basically just like play zero drop or one drop artifact, draw a card, just kind of, you know, go through the deck, do some things, but it's not overly powerful. I'm not running any combos in that deck. It's fairly simple to be able to play. I have things where, again, you run ways to be able to tap the artifacts to do direct damage to people, just kind of trying to keep it a very simple play line that, again, doesn't work the best in my play group, but if I was trying to teach a new player how to play Commander, I feel like that might be a good place to start because it is so straightforward. I have cards in there, Guild Globe, Prophetic Prism, things like that. It just says, you know, when it comes into play, you draw a card. And then you're drawing cards off Joyra, and it works very well for that. It's not a great deck, but it's certainly a simple deck that just has everything stapled to the commander. It's very simple. You just need to draw a card. You don't have to worry about Omnath's four landfall effects in this kind of deck. It's really simple to understand whether you're new to the game or you've been playing for a long time.
Yeah, I built I gave away a Phylath deck that I built. It was about half from a box that I cracked and half from what I had on hand. And that's a fairly straightforward deck to build because the way that Phylath is constructed, you're going to just ramp as quickly as possible, try to get Phylath out as soon as possible, generate a whole bunch of plants, and then you're going to start attacking with them, or you're going to boost them, or you're going to do something with them. And in that deck's a very straight... that deck was won by someone who had really never played Commander before. She played it the first time, and she's like, I was doing really, really well. This was a great deck. It was really straightforward, and it's something that, you know, I could just do. And it was fairly easy to build, because it was, okay, what are some very simple things that you can do? Okay, get some landfall effects that are going to buffer you a little bit. So it included those life gain landfalls. It included some other generators of some green plant tokens. It included ways to give things trample. Mm-hmm. It included things to bump up the power of your creatures. Included a couple generic beaters. It is some simple board wipes. Like, it was just some pretty straightforward get lands on the battlefield into your hand, and then find a way to just smash face. And because it was structured that way, it was a fairly easy deck for someone new to pilot.
Yeah, and I feel like this definitely has some crossover potential with the restricted theme here, especially because you can run something like Flying Tribal or just basic keyword Tribal, and mm-hmm. Someone who's just starting the game, I play in my playgroup who runs an Arcades deck. And, I mean, while you can make that complicated, at the very core of it, you're just playing a whole bunch of walls with Defender and beating someone's face in after a while with those cards, because, you know, you just have all that value oozing off the commander. But, again, it's fairly simple to explain to someone that, you know, all these cards can attack when your commander's on the field, or they all have flying, or there's some payoffs. Again, Kanji Sky Warden's a great example of coming out of Commander Legends for this, where you're bumping all of your flying creatures up and you're playing in the two colors that have the most flyers, in white and blue. So mm-hmm. it's really simple to be able to just pick up right out of the box, or, you know, just sit down, play with the deck, and you know exactly what the deck is going to do because it has the effect is stapled to the commander. It's very clear that you're going to be running flying cards, flying birds, whatever. You're going to be playing with flying creatures, payoffs for flying, and then you're just going to be able to buff all your flyers with 10 different ways, or maybe you mess with your opponents in some ways, but at the very heart of it, you can definitely play the deck without ever even seeing it play before, because you know exactly what you're going to get because your commander buffs that strategy.
Exactly. And I think in terms of the overlap, the safe decks are most often going to be some level of restricted and aggressive, I think, is probably what you're going to see. But the core behind the idea is just that you have a deck that you feel comfortable enough that you could play against a new or a relatively new player. Now, I know a lot of enfranchised players don't like playing with the precons because they feel that they're vastly underpowered, and that's fine. You don't have to. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that you should have a deck that you feel you could give to someone who isn't necessarily as sophisticated as you are in terms of understanding the way that the stack works, or the intricacies of this 27 step combo in your Joyra Weatherlight Captain deck, or your Captain Sisse line of play, optimal line of play, something that you could just say, here you go, you can play this, have fun, and they'd actually be able to have a good time with it.
Yeah, that's really how I got into Commander the first time. The shop owner, one night at FNM, again, we had a very small shop, so there were only three or four of us there. It was actually great when I was learning how to play, because I got to learn the game as I went without having to really jump in the deep end with Standard or anything like that. And he offered the opportunity for us to all learn Commander we had never played before and play the original Commander anthology. And mm-hmm. again, I really enjoy playing green. I enjoy playing black. And I was able to play the Marin pre-constructed deck, and that was extremely simple for me to be able to understand. I obviously had some issues trying to understand commander attacks, the concepts of commander, but as far as just creatures die, bring creatures back to battlefield once a turn, that was fairly simple for me to be able to understand because it was a very easy to understand commander, whereas some of the other ones in that set weren't the easiest to understand. But I felt like with Marin, it just right out there on the card, and in my first game, I understood, here's what I want to do. I want to have cards go to the graveyard. I want to be able to get them back for value and then, you know, be able to go on, pump those creatures, and then be able to do damage.
I have a, I have a Marin of Clan Deltoth deck. It's a rat colony deck. Mm. So you just have to make sure that you have two experience counters. And then you're fine. so I think the curve maxes out at like four. So as long as you have four experience counters, you're just like, I have the right number. We'll just move on now.
Yeah, definitely makes sense, but yeah, there.
But you know, and that deck is interesting because it is an example of a bomb aggressive deck that is also restricted, and I would argue is probably also safe.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of taps a lot of those categories, because with a rat colony deck, because you have so many copies of the same card, if you play things that'll bring back all creatures with the same name, well, all of a sudden you have, you know, 15 rats on the battlefield, and if I have a way to give them haste, and all of a sudden, you know, you're beating everyone for whatever number that is, a lot. It's relatively simple because you are attacking with rats, and sometimes you're using them as resources to like skull clamp them or something, but that's something that becomes pretty obvious when you read the cards. And it's also restricted because, again, it is a rat colony deck. So you know that you already have like 27 cards dedicated to just this one copy of this one card, to this one card name.
Mm-hmm.
And that you need synergies that revolve around that. And then it's safe because, again, you basically say, here you go. And it has your straightforward draw, like Night's Whisper, Sign in Blood, Phyrexian Arena, that kind of stuff. Yep. And then it's the most complicated thing is for you to say, well, when should you play Thrumming Stone and should you play Thrumming Stone? And honestly, if you wanted to give it to a newbie, you could just take the card out, because Ripple is a weird mechanic. Just take it out and put in another rat colony, and then problem solved.
Mm-hmm.
Straightforward.
One quick question on this one. Since we did mention Voltron, would you consider certain Voltron builds? I mean, again, not the corner cases like with my Voltron build, but some of your like your Rune or Earl the Miststalker, would you consider that at least in certain builds, if you build it conscionably, could you consider those safe as well? Because you can just tell someone you just need to do 21 commander damage, go nuts.
I think that for the most part, your Voltron decks could be considered safe. I think a problem arises when the table begins to move the crosshairs onto the Voltron player. I think the deck itself is pretty straightforward.
Okay.
Unless the commander, for whatever reason, doesn't have something like native protection. So Ural's a good example because it has Hexproof, right? Mm-hmm. But if you were to do Voltron with something that didn't, then all of a sudden you're talking about, well, you have to explain to the new player that they're going to be building up this Voltron monster, and they have to have a way to protect it, and they need to make sure that they have enough mana to protect it after they've played these things. So you have to, it comes down to how much description do you really need to give a player before they can run the deck.
Yeah, that's definitely something my Voltron deck is not the best at. It has some interesting, somewhat complicated lines of play, and isn't necessarily the most obvious, even though it is definitely a Voltron deck, and it's built around the commander.
We have a Ural player in my playgroup, and what he tends to do is he won't do anything, essentially, for the first, like, six, seven turns of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Until he gets out Ural, and then he'll drop, like, three enchantments. And then, by that point, most of us have either drawn a board wipe, or we are on the verge of playing one anyway, because someone else is a huge threat. So, incidentally, Ural just gets taken out. And it really sucks for that player, because that player is now set behind, you know, a turn or two, or several if they put the wrong auras on it. Voltron is a sticky beast, because it can I think it really can go in a bunch of different ways. I think the question that you need to ask yourself is, if I'm explaining this deck to a person, If I give this deck to someone and I say, here, you can play this. This is how this deck plays. How many sentences, how many words does it take to actually describe how this deck works? If it's play creatures, turn them sideways, have fun. If that's the description, that is a very safe deck because the player is just going to go in and they're going to do just that.
Mm-hmm. Just like Krenko, for instance, or, you know, goblin decks, something like that, where it's just you're going to drop a lot of goblins, you're going to make tokens, and you're just going to beat face with it.
Most goblin decks are constructed that way. Yeah, I have my son, I built, I'm going to call it a Brawl Legacy deck because Brawl is technically not Legacy, but it's built with just cards I had. It's 60 card EDH, right?
Mm-hmm.
He has a, it's a Krenko, the new one, the new Krenko.
Yeah, yeah.
And he, like, he loves playing that because it's pretty straightforward and he's like 8 years old. Like, so he's like, okay, I'm playing goblins. I'm making them bigger. And then I'm going to just make a bunch more goblins. And then I'm going to attack with those. And I just need to make sure that I'm attacking with more than what you have and we're good. Like, it's very straightforward.
And it's definitely an, it's all so fun to play, even as a player who's now played a lot more Magic and myself recently with COVID and all that. I found myself playing a lot more than I did previously. And having a safe strategy like that is definitely something easier for me that if I was able to play with my friends in person or, you know, just even at the local game store, it'd be a lot easier to just pick up a safe deck and just be able to play that because you know exactly right out of the gate there, even you can play it. Even if you're not quite sure exactly where the deck's going, a little bit of instruction, you can basically take that vehicle out for a test drive versus trying to figure out a storm deck, which I will never understand.
Right. So I think, so just to kind of, I want to kind of summarize here
mm-hmm.
why I think it's important for you to have, because I kind of talked a little bit about it, but why I think all of these are ultimately important. I think you ought to have that bomb style deck in your arsenal or in your stable, because those, I think those bomb effects or those bomb sub strategies or those bomb focus decks, these glass cannon decks, I think they make for very interesting stories, if nothing else. You know, that one time I managed to pull off that combo when no one was expecting it. That's a great story. It's nice to have those. These electioneering type decks, I think, really push you to understand threat assessment, and it pushes the table, I think, to understand threat assessment and resource availability in a very specific way. Mm-hmm. Because whether it be group hug, in which you're trying to give all of these extra resources to people, or if it's in something like this mutual destruction where you're depriving them of their life points, or you're sort of redirecting blame from yourself to other people, that politicking really gets you to understand who's doing what, why they're doing it, and how you should be assessing the board, regardless of what people might be saying. And I think that that's something that we talk about politics, and a lot of people sort of scoff at it, but politics in the game is, it's a natural part of this being a multiplayer game. And mm-hmm. I think that in understanding the politics and in having a political spin in at least one of your decks, you force the table to sort of really think hard about what they're doing and why they're doing it. And I think that's very important.
Mm-hmm.
I think having an aggressive deck is very important because sometimes you only have 20 minutes for a game. And sometimes you just need a deck that's going to do a bunch of damage super quickly. So you do things like you play that game that has the Sulfuric Vortex and the Havoc Festival and the Mana Barbs in it, because you need people to be taking 6-7 life damage at a time.
Yep.
So that you can finish the game and go. I'm reminded of a Commander's Brew episode where they had a quick game deck where it was essentially that. You were just basically just having people take massive amounts of damage so that the game was over as quickly as possible. And I think that's important.
Oh, that sounds really intriguing. It reminds me of my buddy's Torbran deck. He obviously mono red, and he does run Sulfuric Vortex, a couple of the other cards that force you to take the damage. You're taking plus two whenever Torbran's out on the field, and not only is it nice and aggressive and it definitely keeps the game moving, but it also makes an interesting dynamic because it is a symmetrical effect. So even he's taking the damage, but he's still coming out ahead versus the rest of us because he's only taking two damage from that every upkeep, and while we're taking four. So we have to adjust our lines of play to try to make sure that we're not killing ourselves in the process.
Exactly, which is one of the reasons why my Xantcha deck is built largely with symmetrical effects. There are some non-symmetrical effects, but if there's an old card, if there's a symmetrical version of an effect, I will always lean towards that one than the one that's putting me ahead, because I can then say, look, you're not the only one taking damage here. We're all taking damage, okay? Yeah, I played the card, but you know what? I'm taking the damage too. You're the one who's being greedy, it's not me.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at that effect, and I think it's definitely an interesting lesson for a lot of other players out there. I mean, for instance, for me, I don't typically try to run those because I feel like it could blow up in my face, but again, that's just because I haven't developed that level of comfort with some of my decks where I'm willing to take that extra damage. It's probably an evolution where at some point I'll be able to be more willing to play that sort of thing. And again, some players are going to be more willing to play that than others, but it's definitely an interesting... definitely an interesting effect that changes the games, that ever since he put that card in the deck, the games against him have been vastly different and, frankly, make you think a lot more. And I think that's made them a lot more fun than they were before.
Yeah, I think a big part of it is that, at least for me as a player, I don't really care about losing for, like, I mean, I care if I lose for, like, you know, six games in a row. But like for the most part, as long as I'm not being taken out first or second, I'm okay with second place most of the time. So like I said, that Xantcha deck, it's mostly a Kingmaker deck. There's not really a great way of taking the first place spot unless, you know, you happen to price a progress at the last minute. And there's been more than one time where I've cast specifically Price of Progress. Where I've cast Price of Progress knowing that I was going to die when the spell resolved to take out some other player. Okay. Because it's being played like a Rakdos deck. Like, yeah, sure, I'm going to die, but I'm taking you down with me, so it's fine. As long as I've sort of accomplished that mini goal, I'm fine with it. So as a player, I'm fine losing most of the time. I mean, obviously I want to win every once in a while or come close to it, but like I'm fine with that. So I think that's a large part of the reason why with a lot of these effects, I'm like, fine, just, I don't care if I'm taking damage. Yeah, I might lose, but that's not the end of the world because we'll just shuffle up and we'll play again and that's fine.
Mm-hmm. So and because you winning the game ultimately doesn't matter because we are shuffling up again and playing, and it definitely has that interesting dynamic with the other players as well.
Yeah, I mean, if I wanted to win the game, I wouldn't be playing with the Xantcha deck. I'd be playing with one of the other decks. So, you know, my accidentally broken Slivers deck. And then I think, like I said before, I think having a restriction in every deck, I think, is probably a good exercise to have. Like even my most powerful deck, which is probably that Gerard deck, has the restriction in that more than half the creatures have to be Phoenixes. So that's my sort of restriction on that deck. And like, I intentionally don't include other things because I feel like it's too much. So I sort of restrict myself in terms of the power of the effects as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that having that restriction is good because one, it keeps you from snowballing your deck to a point in which you have to completely tear it apart, or you become so invested in the cards that are already in it that you can't cut them. And I think that happens with a lot of players, is they'll play a deck and they'll gradually increase the power level. And then it reaches a point where it becomes obvious that it's too strong for their playgroup or for their meta. And they go to make a cut, but it's been so long that they have an emotional investment and a story behind every card. So they can't do it. So for me, I'm constantly tinkering with my decks. So I'm constantly looking to see if I can change effects. So I just, in that deck in particular, I just switched out Darksteel Mutation for On Thin Ice.
Okay, yeah. Makes sense.
Because of comparable effects. It's arguably better because it's a lower mana cost, but at the same time, it's also something that could potentially die to land removal, right? Someone could blow up the land, and then all of a sudden, well, okay, they Field of Ruin my card, so now, well, they get their thing back.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it felt like a compromise in having that removal, decreasing my curve, but also sort of allowing more opportunity for interaction in a way that is a little bit more accessible. I posted this earlier on Twitter today that I'm a big fan of like the Magus cycle.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big fan of people doing things like including Magus of the Moon as opposed to including Blood Moon, because Magus of the Moon's on a body, so there's more ways to answer it. If you're playing that black deck, they have a way of answering that besides like Feed the Swarm.
Yep.
Right, they can go and they can say, okay, well, I'm gonna kill the creature and then I'll have access to my utility lands again, my Urborg will turn back on, whatever,
because that's what black does best is creature removal, honestly, at least single target removal, and you're allowing them the opportunity to be able to play in that game versus otherwise, you know, playing in a game the other night where all four of us were playing in a mono black throwdown on Summon Skull's channel. And it was very frustrating to try to deal with enchantments because we're all playing mono black decks. Honestly, what are we going to do about that Revel in Riches that's out on the battlefield? Because none of us can deal with it. So, that's a very interesting take on that. I really like where that's going.
I feel like when you have the option to play a card that will allow, when you have the option to play a card that will allow for interaction, you should opt for that as opposed to something that's going to be much more difficult to deal with. Because I feel like the interaction is the largest part of the game. And yeah, sure, they'll have answers for some things, but at a certain point, people will run out of answers. And then at that point, I feel like it's fine for the game to just sort of be done.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, another example is the Hellhound that was in Theros Beyond Death.
Okay.
Kunaros.
Yep.
The Hound of Athreos, right? It has creature cards in graveyards can't enter the battlefield, and players can't cast spells from their graveyards. Poses a lot of graveyard strategies. But it's a much fairer card, in my opinion, than something like Rest in Peace or Leyline of the Void. Because if I'm playing, let's say I'm playing a Red Phoenix, I'm playing a Red Phoenix's deck. I don't really have a whole lot of answers to an enchantment that is turning off my graveyard. And yeah, that's a thing that I need to just be aware of, that graveyard hate exists, but there's a big difference between playing something like Kunaros, where it's a body that I can remove via creature removal and then get my engine back online, or like a Bajuka Bog, which, yeah, will toast my graveyard, but then I can fill it back up.
Mm-hmm. Or
like
summon
a Scavenger Grounds or something.
Or
like
Tormod's Crypt or Grafdigger's Cage do the same thing. But at least in red, you can blow those up because they're artifacts. And if red has something that's really good, it's really good at doing, it's artifact removal.
Exactly. Most colors have an answer for most permanent types or have a way of working around it. So, like, yeah, okay, I could Chaos Warp it. Fine. But, like, that's about all you can do in red. Like, okay, sure, I'll make it an artifact and then blow it up. Like, okay, we're going to include Liquid Metal Coating in every mono red deck? I mean, we could. I'd be fine with that. But, like, that seems kind of silly.
Yeah, it does.
That's our solution to this instead of players just thinking for a couple seconds and saying, I know that I want to win the game, but at the same time, I want other people to have the opportunity to play the game.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think that's really what it boils down to, for me at least.
This is something that's interesting about my personal playgroup from some people from my LGS, and we've effectively removed or slash banned all of the win conditions, specifically cards saying you win the game, out of our decks because they ended up not being all that much fun to play against, because basically I do this and I win the game. So it ends up always being, well, typically whoever has the biggest swings or forces someone to mill out wins. And you can interact with that. You can destroy the creatures that I'm going to be swinging in with, or I can destroy your artifact whatsoever. But if you drop that Approach of the Second Son, for instance, is one of those that I used at the beginning. Is not you unless you have a counter spell in hand, you're basically forked the second time it comes out on the battlefield. And we determined that it wasn't the most fun to play against that because you couldn't interact with it, versus just getting one of the guys has an Ur-Dragon deck versus just being run over by 10 dragons all with haste. I mean, that just seems like a very simple win con in our group. It happens all the time.
Yeah, it's just... I don't know what it is about... I don't know what it is about talking to people on the internet, but for whatever reason, when talking to EDH players, the mindset tends to be into one of two camps. There's the one camp that says that you should have an answer to everything at all times, and if you don't have an answer or a solution to it, that's your fault. And then you have this other camp which says, I should just be allowed to do whatever I want and not have to worry about people messing with my stuff. So you have these sort of two ends of the spectrum where you have one group saying, essentially, you have 80 slots of your deck are dedicated to lands and removal of some sort. Mm-hmm. And then this other group which says, I might have a board wipe, I might have targeted removal, but I'm just going to play a bunch of dumb dragons and just hope for the best. And I really feel like the middle, like the actual middle there, is probably more what we should be shooting for. I see a lot of content creators tend to lean more towards the having answers for everything. And yes, I agree that you should have answers. You should have answers in your deck. That's obvious, I think. But I think also you should, when constructing your deck, think about your threats and how many answers there are to the threats that you're putting in your deck. Because if the only answer to the threats in your deck is a counter spell, I don't think that that's a good card for you to be including, maybe.
Mm-hmm. And that's what we found out in my playgroup, is that it's more fun to be able to just drop creatures or have some problematic enchantment or something. Or, like, for instance, when we were playing on Monday, I milled everybody out using an enchantment. But it was out there for, like, mm-hmm. 15 turns as I was slowly milling everyone out of the table before finally using a bomb play, windfalling for 33 at the end of the game. But, again, it took me, like, an hour to construct this. They had ample opportunities and the right colors to be able to deal with it. They just didn't blow up my enchantment. They easily could have, and it would have set me back considerably, but they had the opportunity to blow that up, and I gave it to them on a stick. I had a counterspell in hand, but I didn't use it, and frankly, I try not to run that many counterspells unless someone's trying to really go off to win the game. So it's just personally how I build decks, that I like to have those interactions and some answers, but again, I'm also in the camp where I just kind of like having some fun cards that are a little bit weird and maybe don't do the best in the deck, but they're just fun to play.
So you're talking about cards that say you win the game. One of probably my favorite pet cards is Mechanized Production.
Okay, yeah.
And one of the reasons that I like it is because the decks that I tend to run it in are decks where the tokens that are being generated are tokens that I'm probably going to not... like have stick around for a while afterwards. So they're like treasure tokens or mm-hmm. clue tokens. So I have Mechanized Production in that Flibblethip deck. One of the sub themes in that deck is Blue's Clues. So it basically has all the blue cards that make those clue tokens.
Okay, gotcha.
So I tend to sack them quite often to draw that extra card, because again, I want to try to get, I am sort of self milling to some extent through card draw. And so Mechanized Production is out, and yeah, I might have the right number of clues to where I'm going to win on my upkeep, but I'm probably cracking those at the end step the person before so that I can draw the cards. And I feel like that's one of those very fair cards, because there are at least two ways to solve that problem. There are at least two ways to solve that problem. You destroy the artifact that it's on. You destroy the tokens that are... that are approaching the critical number, or you destroy the aura. So any of those will get rid of that alt win con.
So I just wanted to wrap up here. If you had any other thoughts about the safe deck.
Not really. I think this is one of those that everyone that most people will agree you should have a deck that you can play with new players or that you could give to a new player. I think an enfranchised player of knowing what level that is fairly difficult. I think if you are an enfranchised player and you want to have yourself a safe deck, I think what you should do is you should go get a precon. And precons are usually constructed so that there's one, two, or three different routes to the way that the game plays.
Mm-hmm.
So I would go and I would eliminate one of those routes, or two of them if there's three, and just try to fill the deck with more cards that synergize with one line of play. And try to do it in a way that doubles the effects that were already included in the precon. So if it's including aura enchantments for ramp, include more of those, because that's fine. That's just repeating, that's replicating the effects. It's going to make the deck stronger, for one, and two, it's going to be more intuitive for the person who's piloting that deck. And I think you should also think carefully about what power level you were at when you started playing EDH. Now, I know that that's not going to be a good indicator for everyone, because some people transition from, like, competitive play. But remember that the stack is a weird thing. The mm-hmm. stack doesn't exist in other games. Like, the concept of the stack, it kind of exists in Yu-Gi-Oh!, but not really, with, like, chaining of cards. But the stack is a concept that most people don't understand, especially casuals who don't really play beyond kitchen table magic.
Mm-hmm.
They play things at sorcery speed. So if you can put in a sorcery, or you can put in a body that will do an effect, you should probably just put that in instead of throwing in an instant that has to be done at the very last possible second. And mm-hmm. try to make the lines of play as close to land, play, attack, go as possible. Because that's how you teach. Look at the decks that are included for things like Card Kingdom includes some intro level decks.
The battle decks, and, yeah.
The battle deck. And they're very much constructed. They have some interesting effects in them. I bought a couple from my son when I was teaching him.
Mm-hmm.
They have some interesting effects. And yeah, they could be better, but they're also very straightforward. It's you're playing your lands, you're ramping your lands if you can. You're playing bodies that sometimes have effects, and you're swinging and you're attacking. You're doing some low-level control, tapping down creatures or what have you, but for the most part, you are just trying to aggress. If you can add those aggressive windshield wiper components to it and sort of trim down the theme of an existing precon to like an actual play a line of play, then I think that you can find yourself a reasonably good safe deck. And if you're not sure, try it out. Try giving it to a new player and seeing how they do with it. Or ask people. You can post deck lists on the web and be like, hey, would this be a good deck for beginners? Yeah, there's going to be a lot of garbage in there where people are saying, well, you should include this obscure card because it'll work the best under these circumstances. But go to content creators that you trust. There are a lot of really good content creators who do focus in on that kind of deck. I think of the Commander Social guys, the CMDR Central guys. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're kind of personally very high level playing people, but I think they have a reasonably good idea of what a beginner should be able to sort of wrap their heads around. And if you don't know, come to me, I guess. I can probably help, or someone. I'm sure you'd be happy to look at a couple decks and say this is good for a beginner or this is not.
Yeah, definitely. Since I'm not that far removed from being a new player, I only started playing a couple years ago on a lark. I had taken a long time off from card games, as I mentioned in my first episode, and it took me a while to get back into card games, but I do remember what confused me the most about trying to learn Magic, and I learned over time through watching videos, listening to content creators, podcasts, and just playing the game. But yeah, I could do a fairly good job of telling people how to build a safe deck, because I actually kind of build a lot of those elements into my decks personally. I try to find some cards that do some basic things that may not be the most powerful, but again, they're fairly simple to be able to play.
Powerful decks can be fun. I'm not going to argue with that. That would be a silly, silly thing to argue.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun to do big, stupid, splashy things. But at the same time, it's a lot more fun for me, at least, for me to have a back and forth, to actually have it. You're essentially having a discussion or having a conversation with your table through your cards. You're doing a thing, someone else is doing a thing to respond to that, and you're going back and forth. And you're talking to each other about who you should attack, who you should not attack, whose Smothering Tithe is worse than whose Rhystic Study, whatever the hell's on the board, right? You're talking about what the threats are, who's the threat. You're often finding yourself, you know, BSing with one another and doing a bunch of other ridiculous things. And I think that for me, that's the biggest part of EDH, and I think that that's something that you miss when all you focus on is trying to play the strongest card or the best card or the most optimal line of play. I think what you should be thinking is, what's going to be the most fun to do right now? And I know that that's kind of subjective, but there are plenty of times where I pull up that Recruiter of the Guard in my Gerard deck, and I could go get that Flayer. I could go get it, and I could start winning the game right now. But instead, I go pull a random Phoenix that has two mm-hmm. toughness, because I'm not ready for it. I'm not ready for this game to end, and no one else is. We're on turn 4, turn 5. Like, we're not ready for this to be over, so why am I going to play like I'm trying to finish it?
Mm-hmm.
And so, I think that if you keep that sort of thing in mind, I think that you'll find that a safe deck really isn't that difficult if that's your goal. If your goal is just to try to make a deck where someone's going to play it and they're going to say, I'm having fun, I don't want this to stop.
Yeah, so again, kind of want to wrap things up here. I really, really like this acronym, BEARS. We've had a great conversation about this. I love the bear pun coming from you, especially. And it just makes a lot of sense. It's made me think about potentially introducing this to my play group. My friend Ryan, who's on the podcast sometimes, he's trying to branch out and build new decks. So I feel like this is kind of a perfect way to kind of get him to think about what he wants to build for his next deck. He just bought a pre-con. We just played with it for the first time on Monday over webcam. And I think it's just one of those things where it kind of gets the conversation started. And really, in our format especially, that conversation with the Social Contract Rule Zero being the most important aspect of our format here, this definitely adds some deeper understanding than just saying the common archetypes. Because the common archetypes, you can have the power levels and all the controversy goes with that. You can talk about having those specific archetypes, yes, but I think ultimately, you're right, it does come down to what do you want the game to look like, what do you want your deck to look like, and how is it going to play? So I feel like this is actually a better way of looking at those decks versus just saying the archetype, given how those power levels can fluctuate so much from deck to deck.
Yeah, I'm not a huge, like, I created a taxonomy, but I'm not a big fan of taxonomies because I feel like they tend to pigeonhole people into thinking in those absolute terms. And one of the biggest things here is that your deck, it probably doesn't fall into just one of these categories. It probably falls into several, and that's perfectly fine, because this is just a way of you trying to communicate something that your deck does. One of the biggest things that's missing from that Rule Zero conversation that at least I've seen in people talking about it is it becomes reduced to what's your power level.
Mm-hmm.
And power itself is such a subjective concept, because yeah, sure, there might be a way to concretely define power based on card synergy and yada yada yada, a multi-variable dimensional space. Like, I understand that that is in principle possible. However, I can tell you for certain that if you handed me a 10 power level deck, it's not going to be played at a 10 power level.
Mm.
One, because I probably don't know how to play it at a 10. And two, because that's not how I play Magic. So it's probably going to be closer to an 8 or a 7, depending on how much room I have to play down. And I know that people hate the phrase playing down a deck, but that's what you should do. If you are overpowered in a pod, you shouldn't be trying to optimally play anything. You should be trying to optimize the fun factor, not optimize your chances of winning. And I struggle to understand. Like, I understand that spikes are a thing, and I understand that there are people who that's why they come to Magic, is to win. Mm-hmm. But it's so divorced from the way that I play that I don't get it. And this is going to turn into a tirade, so I'm going to end it by just... By just saying that I think if you think about the way that you think about what you want from the game and what you want from the decks and what you want from the experience of playing the game, I think if you think long and hard about those three things, you can start to see how having these various types of decks in your arsenal are going to give you different ways of tapping into those different aspects. Like, sometimes, yeah, I just want to win, so I have that explosive deck. Sometimes I just want to sit, drink, and have fun with my friends, so there's going to be a lot of politicking involved. Sometimes I just want to do stupid, splashy things, so I'm just going to be aggressive. Sometimes I'm playing with new people, so I want a safe deck. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I want to express myself creatively, so I add restrictions to my deck, whether that be the budget, theme, or whatever. Right? They're all serving different functions, and they're all allowing me to experience this game in a way that sort of taps into all these different goals that I have to accomplish in EDH.
Mm-hmm. And I'm really impressed by this one. So yeah, I'll definitely be revisiting this at some point when I look into, you know, working on my existing decks or building new ones. Like, I'm building one right now. I definitely use this document to kind of think about how the deck is going to operate and function before I even finish building it. So I wanted to thank you for being on the show today. We've had a great conversation about this stuff. And where can the listeners find you on the socials?
You can find me pretty much everywhere at Ursa Bearwalker. Easiest way to get a hold of me, if you're trying to get a hold of me, is going to be Twitter, which is at Ursa Bearwalker. It's Ursa, like Urza, but with an S. Bearwalker. It's a pun, see? Because it's like Urza, but it's a bear.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have a pinned post that has a link to a bunch of my stuff. Twitter is going to be the best way to get a hold of me. So
right. Sounds good. And you can find me, MJ, at MTG in Quarantine on Twitter. You can also find back catalog of my podcast episodes on Spotify, Apple Casts, Google Podcasts, and wherever fine podcasts are found and sold. So I want to thank you for being on my podcast episode. Anything else before we wrap up the episode?
I mean, as two wise gentlemen once said, be excellent to each other and party on, dudes. And I have nothing more to say other than that.
All right. Sounds great. I want to thank you for being on the show. It's been great having you. And thank you for listening. My name's MJ, and you've been listening to the MTG in Quarantine podcast. Have a great day and be excellent to each other.